Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's episode of The Bend. I am really pleased to have Dr. Amanda Donnelly with me today. When I was managing hospitals, Amanda used to write, and I used to love to read her columns because we're like sisters. We believe the same things about communication. And she has been in the veterinary profession for more than a minute, sort of like me, and has a great perspective on life. So she is also a well-known speaker. She's been Speaker of the Year. She was the past president of Vet Partners Association. And we are going to talk about the new book that she has just written, because that's very exciting and has just launched. So we're going to talk about that. But Amanda, thanks so much for jumping on the show here today and taking your time. I know your speaking schedule is busy. We're getting back to in-person stuff. Us adrenaline junkies are kind of loving that, seeing our audiences again. So welcome.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Thanks for having me. And yes, it's so wonderful that the live, you know, in-person events are coming back, you know, actually get to, and sometimes now we're seeing people without masks on.
Oh my gosh, really? We can see some smiles again. And that's super, super nice. Yeah. So I have an inclination of how you got into this profession, because your dad owned a veterinary hospital. Did you feel compelled or drawn into doing that just because of proximity, or was it something you still always wanted to do?
Yeah, that's a great question. So yes, I'm a second generation veterinarian, grew up in my dad's practice, and I started going with him to, he had an animal hospital in suburb of Kansas City. So on the weekends or after hours, I would go with him either to see emergencies or to take care of the boarders, any hospitalized patients, and, you know, to feed and clean them and all of that. And as the story goes, which I don't know if I really remember it or I've just been told the story, so I think I remember it. But the story goes that I looked at Dad at one point when I'm like, you know, 10, and said, Dad, if I become a veterinarian, you know, will they call me doctor? And he goes, well, you know, of course they will. And so I was like, yay, I want to be a doctor just like my dad. So I worked for Dad all the way through middle school, high school, and on. But when I was in high school, and then, you know, when I was a senior making that decision to go to college, I did have a very purposeful, thoughtful, okay, do I really want to be a veterinarian? Because I didn't want to go be a veterinarian just because Dad did it. And like, that's, you know, I'd been working all those years for my dad. And the obvious other career for me to choose was to be a lawyer. And the reason for that is when I was in speech and debate, when I was in high school, I excelled in speech and debate. And so that was the, you know, everybody that was really great on the circuit, it's like, oh, well, they're all going to go to law school, which, I mean, my debate partner did go to law school. So I was, my three choices I thought were, I'm either going to be a veterinarian, I'm going to be a lawyer, or I'm going to be a flight attendant. Because I thought that seemed super glamorous and I could travel all over. Well, that got nixed pretty early on because I thought, no, I don't know that that's really what I want to do. But no, it was definitely from the very beginning when I went to college. I mean, it was immediately the track to be a veterinarian. So the answer to your question is absolutely, I was drawn to it.
So obviously that worked out for you. You practiced with your dad, but how did life throw you a curveball?
Yeah. So, well, you know, I think there has kind of been two major curveballs, sort of both that, you know, with my personal and my professional life. And I think the first one, you know, probably came when I left clinical practice and took a professional services veterinarian job. And so I did practice for about 15 years. And then I was chief of staff of an emergency hospital in Kansas City. And I had been hired by shareholders once they sold the practice after a period of like 1 to 2 years, the new owners were like, yeah, we think we want to go a different direction. And they didn't renew my contract. So I was like, well, okay, what now? And I, at that point in time, I had practiced for a long time and I grew up in the profession and I really had a strong interest in business. So I did seek out corporate opportunities and interviewed for an entire year. And during that year just did relief work. And so I moved from, so that was the first curveball, because I moved from Kansas City area, all the way to Orange County, California. And that involved selling my house. So I sold the house in Kansas City, bought a new house in California, sold my car because I got a new car, you know, company car in California. left all my friends and family and moved to Orange County, California, where I knew nobody. And fun little fact, one of the first people I met was Peter Weinstein, who But moved to Orange County. So I moved, gave up everything, and was all by myself. And the thing that was probably the difficult part of that is that all of a sudden, some people would be like, oh, okay, so you used to be a veterinarian, which is a real pet peeve of mine, is that just because I'm not practicing over the years, people are like, oh, you used to be a veterinarian. I'm like, yeah, still a veterinarian, you know, not practicing. So that was, it was a real transition, you know, to do that. But I would say that by far the toughest challenge has probably been like the last 5 years, you know, really kind of started around 2017, went through some personal strife, lots of grief, lost my mom, got divorced, my dad sold the family house, you know, which was a loss, you know, where I, you know, grew up as a child, had a couple of health scares, lost my brother just about 18 months ago. So a lot of grief and kind of coinciding with all that starting was getting my business back on track because I really had, you know, was unhappy, but not willing to admit it and had really not done everything I wanted to do to grow my business, you know, because I was trying to keep other people happy. So a lot of change, a lot of upheaval, you know, since 2017.
Yeah. So obviously, you know, there's a lot of challenges and I know your family. I mean, honestly, I just felt so bad for you. It's like we're in the middle of a pandemic and your family is just, I mean, there's a death like all the time. You're like, no, not another one. And yeah. I know how hard that was and the isolation too, because that was another part of, you know, sometimes when we grieve with people and to be isolated from people too is making it even harder to process grief. Tell me, you know, kind of how do you overcome and keep moving through? I mean, I think that's one of our big challenges always is when we're hit with a barrage of things and they seem to come in clusters. They really do. How do you just keep putting one foot in front of the other and moving forward?
Yeah. Because for me, it was a lot at once. The, you know, the divorce happened first, then my mother died and that was a major loss. But then right before I moved, I actually lived in Florida for, like 14 years, hard to believe, but because I never really wanted to be in Florida in the first place, but you know, life happens. And so once I could move anywhere I wanted to, I decided to move to Nashville, Tennessee, and I absolutely love it here. But right before I moved, I had a health scare, my mother died, and I get to Nashville in late January, and then the pandemic hits. So I'm like, well, this is just great. Now I don't know anybody and I'm an extrovert. So not a good combination. And I'm grieving, like you said. So, you know, for me, it's always been about, I am a strong proponent of therapy. You know, I have had, you know, good therapists in my life. I've been very blessed with that. I really, totally aside from, you know, therapy or whatnot, but I've gotten a lot of tools and resources over the years. So I sort of believe in working what I call a program, and I'm using that term very loosely, meaning that I actually schedule time for grief. You know, when I started, so fun fact about this, you know, not really so fun, but interesting. So I went to the Vet Partners meeting in February of 2020. So the pandemic, like, you know, there was like, some interesting things going on, but we didn't know what was coming. Mm-hmm. And so I went into that meeting and I was just incredibly tired because my mom had died. I hadn't really had time to grieve because I'm packing up this house. I had a health scare and, you know, here I am. And I was talking to Peter Weinstein and he's like, wow, Amanda, that's a lot. You know, no wonder you're so tired. You need to take time for you. And you know how sometimes people will tell you things and you do the, yeah, but, you know, you're either thinking it in your head or you literally say that.
Exactly.
And I sort of was like, yeah, but, you know, I've got a consult coming up and a speaking engagement. Like, it's like, no, like Amanda, you really need to take time for yourself. And he really was like a dog with a bone a little bit over a couple of days. And so finally I was like, oh, okay. Like he's right. I need to do something. So I said, I'll tell you what, I will promise you that by April 15th, like in the next couple of weeks or so, I will decide when I'm going to, where I'm going to go and what I'm going to do. And I will do it by April 15th. So that was, and so I did, I checked myself into a cabin about 2 hours outside of Nashville, you know, near Fall Creek Falls State Park. And, you know, unfortunately the park closed down because of the pandemic. So the whole reason that I went there was to take, you know, Gidget, my dog, and do this hiking and blah, blah, blah. But I was going to do all this grief work. Well, there was a lot of time to do the grief work because there wasn't any hiking that was to be had. But that was my whole idea. Is I brought all of these videos of, you know, my mom and the family. And, you know, I went up there and I thought, well, gosh, I'm not really very unhappy. I don't really feel like crying. Well, that didn't take too long of watching videos and journaling and all of that. And so it was the first time that I had to just be by myself and just have my, you know, massive amount of grief and just let go of everything. And I did a lot of personal development too, which of course that was a little bit of a lesson in frustration because I made all these goals and all these things I was going to do that didn't really happen because of the pandemic, but they still served me well. So, you know, how do you get through it? For me, I believe in scheduling time, having your feelings. I believe in having a vision board, setting some specific goals. One of the pieces of advice that somebody gave me, you know, when I was still in Florida, is she said, you know, what's going to make you happy? Where do you want to be in 3 years? You know, what are the big ticket items? And that's what I put on my vision board. You know, what if you look back 3 years from now, you know, what are you going to want to have accomplished? Mm-hmm. So for me, that's been a lot of what it is, setting some of those goals that are a little bit further out, but then doing the hard work, mm-hmm. you know, the hard work to keep moving, you know, and having your feelings and drawing on the support of, you know, some special people in your life.
Obviously this is, you know, big changes. And I remember when you went to the cabin, remember when you moved to Nashville and you're just kind of there in this new city that, you know, you don't know anybody. And then the pandemic hits. So what was the scariest part of that event for you?
Oh, well, you know what? I paused for a second because everything's going so well for me. But then I'm like, oh, I know what the scariest thing was how am I going to make any money? Because I got there and I remember this fellow that I had a conversation about probably in, I don't know, February or whatever, about doing this speaking engagement in New York. That would have, you know, been scheduled like for, I don't know, March or April, and him, you know, conveying some concerns. And I remember thinking, oh no, that's not going to be any big deal. Now this, you know, so I literally watched all of the speaking just fell like dominoes. And so it was sitting there going, huh, I might not make another dime this year. So that was a little bit scary, but was mitigated by the fact that I knew I would still be okay mm-hmm. because I've made smart financial decisions in my life and I had enough savings, mm-hmm. but it is still kind of scary. It's like, well, I don't want to have to blow through all my savings.
Right. You know? Yeah.
And the other part of it was is very early on recognizing that this was not going to go well for me with my personality of, you know, being so isolated. And fortunately, my niece and her wife live in Nashville. So at least I was able to have contact with them, you know, throughout the pandemic, and we would get together for dinners and, you know, they were working out of the house too. So we weren't concerned about exposing each other because neither, you know, they didn't have exposure to people and neither did I. But that was really, I think, the scariest part, you know, was how am I going to make a living? What am I going to do? How long is this going to, it became pretty obvious pretty early on that this was not going to end right away. No. So,
yeah. Well, it's funny. I had that conversation with Dr. Wendy Hauser and she says, you know, I'm really concerned for you as an independent consultant. You know, she was working for an insurance company and most of my friends had like jobs. And if you're then you are a speaker or you do consulting, then people don't want you in their building. you are isolated out there and you're like, oh, how am I going to do this work? But thank God for Zoom, right? Because
oh, yeah.
Oh, my word. What would we have done without Zoom? And truthfully, I think we found out that a lot of the work that we do could absolutely be done over digital method. And it saved us a lot of travel. And we were, I mean, everybody just pivoted. And that was, I think, the most important part about all of it. We just, you do what you do and you figure it out. And I think you and I both do management consulting. And one of the things that we do is figure it out, you know, whether for ourselves or for people. This time we just figured it out for ourselves, you know, how to work around it. But you're right. I mean, you're sitting there going, am I going to have any speaking engagements? Am I going to have any money? Are my clients going to lock their doors? Because we were at that point in time just thinking everybody was going to have to shut down. And in some hospitals and some practices they did, and other practices they just kept on doing what they'd always done. But it was a very difficult time. And then that first year was crazy with the PPP loan information and everybody asking questions and EIDLs and, you know, what am I, the protocol changes and the change again and change again and change again. It was like drinking water out of a fire hose, trying to help your clients just
navigate. Well, and what I found very quickly was that my clients were too busy to even be talking to me on the phone.
Oh, yeah.
You know? So I had everything on Zoom calls, but that was the hardest thing. But for me, it was, you know, I hesitate to call it a silver lining because I don't see, there's not much silver lining with COVID, but it did allow me to do major projects. Mm-hmm. So I did a major project where I built out a communications training program for a company. And that took a lot of time and, you know, and I had the time and I was at home. And then of course, like you said, the virtual presentations started rolling in and then, you know, and then wrote the book, which, you know, took an enormous amount of time. So I had time for those major projects. So I think you're right. You know, Debbie, it's that pivot because I don't, you know, I wouldn't have very easily, if at all, been able to do those projects if we hadn't had a pandemic. You know, that those are things that came out of the pandemic for me.
Yeah, I agree. There was a lot of production of content and that I would not have had time to write because I would have been traveling too much to do it. I think the thing I missed about traveling, though, is that was where I always would listen to audiobooks and driving in the car and in the airplanes. And then I realized that I wasn't doing that stuff. I was like, oh, I'm behind on my reading. My, you know, my books are piling up on the shelf. And I've always been an avid reader. And to find out that I was so busy working that I didn't have time to do a lot of the research that I like to do so that I could do the work better was a struggle for me too. But I want to talk about, you know, writing your book, because this was not the first book you've ever written. You have written, is this number three? Or you are participating?
I wrote one book previously. That's the 101 Practice Management Questions Answered. And then I've done multiple book chapters. So I've done book chapters, I think four for Blackwell's 5-Minute Consult. And then I think three or four chapters for pet-specific veterinary care. I think I have that name right. But no major book, you know. So this project, Leading and Managing Veterinary Teams, was a major undertaking.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about that process, because I think a lot of people, and, you know, I've written a book with Wendy, and it's a process. I mean, it's a lot of work, and it's a lot of back and forth and edits and so many more decisions than you think, rather than just sitting down and just writing stuff. So talk a little bit about, you know, how do you write a book?
Yeah, well, I mean, the beginning is, what's the purpose, you know, sort of doing that proposal, you know, what's the purpose of this book? How is it going to be different than other books that are out there? You know, why are you writing it? What need does it fulfill? So that's sort of the beginning, which this book was always, the themes are leadership, communication, and culture. And what was different or is different about it is it's approachable, it's applicable, it's practical, it's, you know, it's 10 chapters. And so it's comprehensive, but the core of the book, seven of those chapters are all about team development. And so it's something that, you know, is designed for managers to be able to pull off the shelf, get practical advice that they can immediately act upon. And so that was, you know, that's kind of the first part of it. Then it's the outline, you know, what are the chapters and what are the names? And then what are all the bullet points of what you're going to write? You know, so the first process is getting the structure in place. It's like, you know, what's the structure of this house? Once that's all done, you know, then it's time to write. And I did a lot of investigation on that writing process. Like you said, one of the things, for example, that I did that might not be intuitive is to write the preface at the end. So you would think, oh, I'll write the preface first. But in actuality, I wrote the preface at the very end, which made a lot of sense because then you could reflect, you've already gotten the book. And in my note, my preface is called A Note from Amanda, is, you know, what you're going to get out of reading this book. Plus, I have kind of a little story that bookends, you know, the beginning and the ending of that note. But here's the thing that's interesting. And I acknowledge in my acknowledgements, one of the people that I acknowledge is my niece. And this is why. So I was should have been writing this book starting like now, I think like in May was the idea of 2020. And I had dinner with her and her wife one night. And, you know, we're talking about writing. So she has a PhD in sociology. She is like an assistant or something professor at in sociology at Vanderbilt University. So all of that is to say she's done a lot of writing. So she's like, well, I have this book on writing that you might be interested in. I said, okay, because I've done a lot of writing. I've done all these articles, these book chapters. I'm like, okay. So she gives me this book. There's a little paperback book that's like this thin, all right? And the title, I can't remember the author. The title is How to Write a Lot. And I thought, huh, okay. And I said, well, what did you get out of this book? And she's like, well, you know, there was some good, like, you know, tools and information about, you know, how to be organized, whatever. So I take the book home. And I open the book, and most of the book is about academic writing, so it's not really that applicable to what I was doing. But there was a couple of key factors in this book. So I open this book, and at the beginning, the guy's kind of smarty pants. And he says, here's one of the first tips was you have to write on a regular schedule, like pretty much every day, but has to be a regular schedule. It can't just be this hit or miss. So like if it's, you know, let's say you're going to write 10 to 2 every day, you know, that has to be your schedule. And he says, if you're not going to do that, put this book down and, you know, keep it nice and give it to somebody else. So I'm like, okay, message received, have to have it scheduled. So then the other thing I got was a time tracker. He said, you know, you really should keep track of your time. And, you know, that's a standard productivity tool that a lot of us, you know, have used or, you know, read about. So what I did was, you know, I kept an Excel spreadsheet, you know, what chapter I was working on, how many hours I worked, and, you know, like in terms and how many words that I wrote and would put some notes in. Well, what was a real wake-up call is I know approximately how long it takes me to write, say, a 1,200 word article, right? We write these articles. They're usually say, you know, like today's veterinary business that I write the talk column, it's like 1,200 words, right? And I know how I'm a really slow writer, and I know how long it takes me to write that. And each of these chapters was going to be like 6,000 to 7,000 words. And I did the math. And then I thought, oh, I'm in big trouble. I'm like in super big trouble because
I'm retired before I do.
This is going to take me years. That's all of a sudden the kick in the pants was like, oh, you can't just like dabble, like write just a few, you know, a little bit. So I set a goal. I can't remember. I think the goal was like 500 to 1,000 words a minute or a day or something. So the time tracker really, really helped. So so in answer to your question, how do you write there? You really want to have those daily goals. So do it something regular, have, you know, for me, have that daily goal so you can kind of see if you're on track. Cause I knew like for every month, I had like, I need to get these chapters done by this time, these chapters done by this time. So there was like big chunks, you know, these three chapters. So there was that process. And then, like you said, there's the whole editing process. And so then that's a lot about, you know, looking at how you write and how can it be more succinct? How can it be, you know, more direct? you know, then going through the review process, getting, you know, reviewers, the reviewers that looked at the book gave me some really good feedback that I knew I was on target with a lot of things, but there was one chapter in particular that they made some, you know, pretty critical remarks that were really spot on. And it was, so really what I did was I changed the title of the chapter, but then I also reworked it and kind of massaged it a little bit and got rid of some of the stuff, some of the phrasing that was confusing. So that was incredibly helpful. And so, yeah, I mean, it takes longer than you think. Because I write so much, I never realized till I started it, wow, this is like a major project.
Yeah. I can remember when I first started writing the book, I was writing it by myself and it was about, you know, how to do monthly wellness plans. And I met Wendy at an AHA conference and she was talking about having them in her hospital. So I just called her up out of the blue and said, how'd you like to write a book with me? And she said, yeah, I just saw my practice. I have time to do that. Let's do that. I went, sure. And we met for 15 minutes, right? So we laughed and said we should do a presentation on how to write a book with a stranger because it actually worked out okay. But yeah, she was in Denver and I was in North Carolina and we were each working on these chapters of the books. And so there was collaboration there. And then, Lord, there was math. There was a lot of math because of the kind of book it is. But it really was, you know, quite a process. And I was traveling. And so what you're talking about is like consistently writing every day. I couldn't do it because I'd be gone 4 days at a time and lecturing and then you're coming back. Well, you completely lose your train of thought because a book has to flow from the beginning to the end. And I would end up rereading my chapters over and over and over again to pick up where I left off and continue on with the next chapter. So I see the benefit of everyday steady work on it because you could keep in the moment. You can keep that thread going rather than the start and stop stuff that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you can do that
I would write some days I wrote 6 to 7 hours a day, which was grueling.
I started using Talkatoo dictation and it's been wonderful. So you know, I can talk a lot faster than I can type and the thoughts come, but then when I pause, it thinks I quit. So then I have to start all over again. But you know, because you have to stop and ponder a little bit exactly how you want that sentence to come out. So Amanda, you know, thinking about you know, making these decisions. I mean, you also did something that I think a lot of veterinarians think is like nirvana, and that's working for industry and not being in practice every day. But did you find that that was as satisfying as working in practice, or did you, you know, I mean, everything is different, but it's not the end all be all a lot of times.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't give up my 4 years in industry for anything. It was one of the best decisions I ever made because of the long-term impact that it had on my career. The part that was difficult, and I would say that this would be a regret of mine, the part that was difficult was going from clinical practice to just no clinical practice at all. And I absolutely loved practice. I did about half general practice and about half emergency medicine. Loved them both. I loved the adrenaline rush and the, you know, chaos and the, you know, fast pace of ER. I also just love both with general practice and ER, the client connections. So I really missed that. Because I was doing ER, it had really kind of taken a toll and I was really, you know, high morbidity and mortality rate. I didn't miss that. So if I had to do it all over again, I would do what a lot of professional services veterinarians, I think, do, which is work like one or two shifts a month and keep my hand in. You know, that would be something I would do different looking back. What was so satisfying about the corporate job? Well, number one is I was a professional services veterinarian for the IMS company, you know, which eventually got you know, rolled up in all the way up into Royal Canin, you know, now. And, but it was actually privately owned when I first started working there, but it's just an amazing team of, you know, I still have friends from that group back then, an amazing group of people. I was exposed to a considerable amount of learning. I had media training. I had, my boss knew that I loved to speak. And so he sent me to speaking courses where I was able to hone speaking skills. I got to travel all over because my territory was California, Arizona, and Hawaii.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So I had to go to Hawaii several times a year. And so, and there was just all these great functions and events, and you worked out of the house. So I took up cycling. I was in California and it was easy to do that because I had this flexible schedule and whatnot. But the other thing is, what really was good for my career is all of the people that it exposed me to that still today, you know, and over the years I knew. So I really expanded my connections. Mm-hmm. You know, I worked with a lot of specialists. So expanded all my connections with a lot of different veterinarians and specialists at universities, as well as in private practice. A lot of people in industry that maybe they've moved around different jobs, but you know, I still today, I'm actually sometimes working for a company and I knew maybe somebody in that company way back, you know, to my IMS days. So it was great. It was a great period of time in my life. And other than missing clinical practice, I felt like it was a really great company with a great product and just a fabulous team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think some of my early work when I was still managing was with Novartis Animal Health. And Novartis just had the best group of people. And I still see many of those people. A lot of them now work for NAVC. Those connections are still out there in the world. And, you know, I've always laughed because the business cards change, but the people really don't. They just go to other companies or they move up the ladder and they're somewhere else. So never burn your bridges in veterinary medicine, because once people get into it, they never leave it. It's such a good profession. They always tend to stay, especially in the sales and industry. So looking back on all that, what do you consider your biggest career mistake?
Yeah, you know, I don't know that there's one. Like I said, I told you the regret, you know, of not keeping my hand in practice. But when I think about a mistake, there's not, you know, at this point in time, I just feel like I've had such an amazing career, both in clinical practice, in leadership positions. I was the first woman veterinarian, first woman that was a president of the Kansas City Veterinary Medical Association. I enjoyed all my time in practice. I enjoyed all my times in corporate. Now I've been doing speaking and consulting, I guess, for 17 years. And, you know, I've had international speaking opportunities and on and on and on. I would say that the mistake, it's not so much that there's like one big mistake, but I think if I look at some of the little mistakes that do make a difference, one of the things that stands out to me is just not asking the right questions, you know, or just not asking any questions at all, you know, because as a consultant, you know, because I have a coaching style and I consider that I do kind of some coaching. I use that term a little bit loosely, but, you know, consultants, we're supposed to give advice, right? You know, people want us to, you know, guide them and tell them like, this is my assessment and these are my recommendations. And my personality being what it is, I love to, you know, talk to people. So what I have learned over the years is that I need to talk less, you know, like in those types of situations, mm-hmm. mostly with clients. And, you know, it's true with your personal life as well, you know, but to ask more questions, better questions, open-ended questions, learn more, you know, and investigate more before, you know, before you speak. And I'm talking more about the relationships. I think I've always been good at asking the right questions so I can make a practice assessment, but I'm talking about the relationships with people, asking more questions rather than, you know, trying to tell them something. Mm-hmm. That's something, that's a skill that I really continue to work on. And I think I can look back at how that has served me well so that I don't make some of the same mistakes that I made before because I'm asking better questions.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we all learn that, you know, when you start out as a consultant, of course you have an MBA, and when you start out as a consultant, you know, a lot of stuff about you know, running a practice. And you're right. People do ask, they want you in there because they want you to help them make it better. But over the years, I found that a lot of people know what's wrong with their practice. They just don't know how to solve the problems. And that's what they want you to help them with. But they have ideas, and either the ideas are supported or edited maybe a little bit, but it's more likely that they'll be successful if they have some of their ideas in the game, rather than just you need to do this, you need to do that. And it's the same, you know, you and I both have talked for many, many years about communication and asking open-ended questions and being a good listener. And it's the same principle with the clients in the exam room. It's a lot of listening and a lot less talking and a lot less lecturing. You know, you need to do this for your pet. And like, what are your goals? You know, what do you want to accomplish for this visit? How long do you want your cat to live? Let's just, let's ask that question. You know, because it could be like, not that long, because this cat's really tearing up my house or driving me crazy, or, you know, I don't like it that much. But I do want to talk a little bit about, how did you learn so much about communication as a veterinarian? Because it's not typical that veterinarians have focused so much on communication skills, and you have been doing that for a really long time. And I know, because I was like, yeah, fangirl when you were writing.
Yeah. So yes, I've always been interested in communication. So it's sort of been this just continuum. The very beginning would be both my parents. My father, I have to give credit, because, you know, he's a good Irishman. He's like got the gift of gab. So I, of course, grew up watching him talk to all these clients, build rapport, trust, show how much he cared. You know, he just built his practice on communication. So I saw that. Now, my mother was an introvert, not anything like my dad at all. She was an introvert. But one of the greatest gifts that my mother gave to me, and I mentioned this in, I guess, my acknowledgments, my mother is the one that I realized, looking back, that suggested that I should join the speech and debate team in high school. That was her idea. And so I, at a very early age, developed all of these communication skills and was, you know, exposed to public speaking. And I thrived and I did that. And, you know, that helped me with other leadership positions and that sort of thing. So I had this interest. So I've always had, from a communication standpoint, part of what I love about speaking is, of course, you have to have great content. No one wants to listen to someone who doesn't have anything worthwhile to say. But to me, it's about the art of the communication, the skills, you know, to actually inspire people and make them laugh and on and on. So I've always had that interest in communication. Now, jumping forward to vet school, one of the people that, well, two different people, I'm really dating myself here, but two people that had an impact on me early on, one is Ross Clark. So Ross Clark, a lot of people watching this are going to go, who's Ross?
Who is that? That's right.
So he's one of these, you know, early practice management consultants and speakers. And he came and spoke to the senior class, and he talked about client communications. And I just soaked all that up. I thought, oh, that's fabulous stuff. And so I was always really interested. And I was always really interested in the business side. And I think because of dad and listening to some practice management, I knew that the communication was important for the pets to get the care that they deserve. So that's really, you know, I would always listen to speakers, consultants talk on communication. So I continued that. Well, then what happened is the trajectory of my life is I realized how important communication was in terms of just relationships in general. And I learned, quite honestly, I learned a lot about communication in therapy, and then a lot of different, you know, books that I would read. I am have gone through the entire, let's see, I guess it'd be 18-hour, very intensive Frank communication workshop. So I drank the Kool-Aid there, because it wasn't Kool-Aid. It was awesome. I remember thinking, nah, this isn't going to work. This is going to take too long to use all these skills. And so I was exposed to and did some actual speaking, you know, with some of the people that, you know, that teach the shared decision-making model and all of that, that are at Guelph and Washington State. And so I really have always been interested in it. And most recently, I guess it would be 2020, my word of the year was communication. because, so I've had a word of the year now for 3 years running. So that was the first year. And it was because communication is so important in everything. It's how I communicate with my clients, how I communicate with my friends and family, you know, just all across the board, just in general. So that's a long-winded answer, but it's all, I've just always had this love of the spoken word. And, you know, that's why I joined the National Speakers Association.
Yeah.
You know,
well, yeah. I tell you, I've always had this kind of dream in the back of my head that one day you, me, and Marion von der Linde would have a communication conference for veterinarians. And that would be all we would talk about the whole time would be communicating, and we would do workshops.
Yes, I'm there.
Yeah. Because this, to me, if we look at all the challenges that we have in veterinary medicine, so many of them are solved if we know how to communicate. If we don't, you know, aggravate our clients to the point where they blow up because we've made poor decisions in word choice, or we are not communicating feedback appropriately with fellow team members because we don't know how to say it gracefully. We say it harshly and judgmentally, because that's where the toxicity comes from. And it's really the root cause of so much of the damage that happens in clinics. And if we could just teach that, you know, if we really could, I think we would solve so much of the problems. And, you know, and like you said, the patients get better care because the clients are collaborative. It's not a battle between us and them and what we want and what they want. It's a collaboration between the two of us to get the pet what it needs. And it's telling a very different story than what I guess we're trained to do out there in the world.
Well, and you're absolutely right, Debbie. And I think part of the challenge too is that there's all these basic skills that sort of have been around forever about building trust and rapport, but then things have changed over time, you know, how we communicate with people and all these different generations. And so the shared decision-making models and, you know, partnering with people for the care of their pets rather than just giving them the lecture, which is, you know, I gave a lot of lectures.
Well, the authority, you know? Right? You're the authority.
Yeah. And so that's what's changed a lot. But I think for what I find to be the most difficult is the implementation piece. So we know, I think teams know that they need communication skills and practice leaders do. And you and I talk about, oh, how important communication is, but it's the actual teaching of that so that somebody then takes that skill. And what I always harp on is people have to practice this.
Yes.
They actually have to practice saying something, and it's not going to go perfect, but it's staying the course and practicing it. Because if people don't practice a new skill and focus on one or two skills, then they just fall back into whatever their normal communication patterns are.
Yeah. It's kind of like algebra. That's the equation I give it is like, I learned algebra in the eighth grade. And if I had to do an algebra equation right now, my solution is to go to algebra.com, put in the numbers and let it calculate the math, because I'm not going to do that. But it's a practice skill. And I think that this is one of the reasons that in the last 2 years, we as a humanity have lost some of our social skills because we've been isolated. And you can see out there with all the, you know, increased violence and the challenging clients who are, you know, just, aren't you glad you're not a flight attendant, right?
Oh yeah, right.
It's really a wise decision on your part is to not go there. But who would have thought if you were on a plane that somebody would actually attack a flight attendant or other passengers on the plane, because it's just not done, right? It's socially unacceptable. And then people are doing this kind of stuff because they're losing their social skills and the inhibition that society puts on us to behave a certain way because we're influenced by the people around us and we're losing our influencers. So it's kind of, it's kind of crazy. But let's talk a little bit about networking, because I mean, you and I met, I don't even know, like Vet Partners, I'm sure, but probably Lecture Circuit and before that. And like I said, always a fan of the things that you wrote, big time. But, you know, think about networking. You mentioned a little bit about the people that you worked with in industry and still having those connections. But How did that help you in your career? And then, you know, we talked about, you know, Vet Partners, and you were the past president, and
I think, you know, I do not consider myself the best at networking. And so what I recognize, though, is those people who are, you know, really good at networking. And so I try to emulate that and be like, oh, wow, I want to be like that. Look how great that is. So I've been on the receiving end of seeing how staying connected to people, because even though I'm an extrovert, once, you know, here I am in my house, I live by myself, it's easy to kind of be isolated because we travel and we see all our friends and colleagues. But you know, you have to pick up the phone, or, you know, you have to really work at it to stay connected, you know, when you're not on the road. And so, like, for example, I'll give you an example. I've done some speaking, you know, with Royal Canin. I know some of the people in Royal Canin. And one of the gentlemen that I know, he, long time ago, I guess he worked at IMS, but we met and kind of got reacquainted several years ago at Western States. And he's done a really good job of connecting me with people that he thinks, you know, we might have some shared business ideas or whatnot. And one of those people was who he reports to is, you know, the head of all of some of the professional services veterinarians, and also involved in the Women's Leadership Initiative. And he introduced me to her. And so she had me speak for the, you know, the Women's Leadership Initiative. And then when I emailed all my contacts list and said, you know, I have this new book, she came back and said, well, let's set up a call to talk about how I can help you promote your book. And I'm thinking, is there a catch here? You know, like, just, she's just going to do, you know, I'm thinking like, oh, she's going to try to pitch me like paid advertising or something, which nothing could be further from the truth. It's just like, oh yeah, we need to get your book out there. We need to let women know about this, blah, blah, blah. And I was, so we talked about, you know, ways to do that and whatnot, and, you know, giving the book as a giveaway and not what. So that's the power of networking. He connected me, you know, with her, and then, you know, she's giving back and trying to help people. So I think a lot of the networking, I think where the power of networking is when you genuinely want to help the other people. Mm-hmm. And I've had a lot of people that genuinely want to help me. And I try to do the same. So I have colleagues that refer me business. I definitely refer business to other, you know, of our friends and colleagues. So I think that the networking really helps with the cross referral. It helps with, you know, me getting speaking engagements. It helps, you know, with me getting clients. But I think it's all about, I think I really realized, though, that you do have to work at it. You can't just sit back and just think it's just going to happen on its own.
Right, right.
You know, yeah. Because there's been a couple of times in my life where I've gotten a little bit isolated from everybody. And as soon as I pick up those connections and do more networking, then that law of attraction really starts working mm-hmm. for me, for sure. Mm-hmm.
You know, if somebody was out there in the world and they were facing a big career decision, what do you think is the piece of advice that you would give them?
Yeah, you know, I guess, I think, you know, something that's sort of top of mind for me now, and, you know, I guess my little bit of words of wisdom, maybe in being in this profession and just being a little bit older, would be to stay true to your core values. Because I think we keep those for granted. And I do know people who have developed their personal core values. I actually had not ever done that. And I'm just quick little bunny trail. I'm a huge advocate of leading and managing by core values. It's very much a part of my book. I was introduced, you know, anybody who gets my book will see, you know, in my acknowledgments who I credit with, you know, the original part of that journey of, you know, about leading and managing by core values. I had never actually developed them for myself, which is not to say that I don't have core values, because obviously I, you know, I think we all have a set of values, but I had never really sat down and pondered that. And when I read Brené Brown's book, Dare to Lead, she is, of course, a big advocate for this, but she's also adamant that you can only have two. It's like two. She makes this a big point of this. No, you can't have more than two core values. And of course, with businesses, as you know, Debbie, you know, most businesses have what, you know, three to eight.
Yeah.
You know?
Somewhere around.
And I kind of like, I don't know how you could only have two as a business. I think you know, four to six is where most of my clients land mm-hmm. up. So I'm like, two? How's that gonna work? But I'm like, okay, it's Brené Brown. So I'm gonna follow this process. So I do her worksheets, and it was very relatively, I wouldn't say it was easy because I spent some time, but it was very obvious. Like, these are my two core values, which are commitment and compassion, and everything can fall under those, you know, because it's the commitment and compassion I have as it relates to my personal pets, you know, clients' pets, clients, you know, pet owners, you know, my family, my friends, community at large, just, you know, that those were it. And so where I'm going with this is that when I went back and I looked at some of those challenges in my life, particularly, you know, the one that I mentioned earlier about, you know, going through the divorce and going through everything, is I realized that some of the decisions that I've made in my life where things didn't go well, whether it was the personal or professional, it's because I went a little astray of my core values. You know, either a bad hire, somebody, you know, that, you know, an employee, you know, didn't have aligned core values. It might be an action that I took that was not good. It was because I wasn't in compassion. You know, I was out of alignment. Mm-hmm. So I realized that the time, so going back to making a big career decision or a change in life, I think you have to say, well, is this aligned with my core values? You know, I mean, I was just speaking in Fort Myers a couple of days ago, and a young woman asked me about some challenges she was having. And she literally said, I don't think I have the same core values as the ownership. And I'm like, well, that's a red flag.
That's a red flag. Yeah.
And, but she didn't want to quit, you know, just like, it was like, no, I don't really think this is quitting. You know, I was trying to get her to reframe. This isn't like you're giving up, you're quitting. Your core values aren't aligned. So always with your big decisions in life, make sure that whatever you're deciding to do, don't sacrifice too much. You know, we have to make sacrifices in life for our family, for our work schedule, you know, whatever. But when you're sacrificing, and it's like what I've been told, be careful what you negotiate away. You know, don't negotiate away the things that are really important.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that's really my biggest, you know, piece of wisdom. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love that. I've always talked about, you know, the importance of core values and hiring to your core values, because if you can hire someone who has an excellent skill set, but if they're not aligned with your practice's core values, they're always going to be that square peg in a round hole, and they're not going to be happy, and you're not going to be happy, and then toxicity is going to creep in. Yes. So it's better to have somebody who believes what you believe and wants what you want. Even if they don't have as great a skill set, you teach the skills, you know, just, but they've got to have that personal alignment with what, you know, you believe in your practice and what they believe too. Otherwise they're never going to flourish there. And I think that's maybe a lot of what is happening. It's funny. I just read something on LinkedIn about the great resignation and how many people are changing their jobs and moving. But the thing is that now they've been 6 months into these new jobs, and they took them for money, and they find out that they're not living in alignment with their values. Oh, and so they're looking for jobs again, because they jumped ship for what looked to be a really great thing, which was a lot more money or whatever big bonus that they were going to have. And then they get into it, and the reality of it is this is a really bad fit. So when you work for somewhere, it should be a good fit for you and a good fit for the business, and then you both do well. But if it's not a good fit, it's always going to be a struggle. You're never going to be happy, and it's always going to be what it could be for either of you.
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Good. Yeah. So I love that. And, you know, one of my favorite books is How to Hire the Right Person for the Right Job. It's written by two Lauries, Laurie Davila and Laurie Kusmark, I think. But they have core values list. And then they have questions that you can ask people based on how to discover what their core values are. And I'm telling you that those are the best questions that I've asked them numerous times in interviewing veterinarians. And it will red flag difficult personalities. It will red flag ethical and moral challenges that people have, you know, where they're not in alignment with the way that the practice thinks. And, you know, you just avoid having a bad hire rather than hiring them and having them fired. Let's just avoid it in the first place. And that's
exactly, you know,
it's hard to say right now with 18 openings for every available veterinarian is to be choosy, but everybody needs to be choosy. And that includes the veterinarians who are out there in high demand. It's not, It's not all about the shiny toys, right? It's not look good on the surface. Ask the right questions. You made a really good point. Ask good questions. That's true. So Amanda, tell us a fun fact about you. Do you have a secret talent, a favorite song, something people would be surprised to know about you?
Yeah. You know, I always struggle with that when someone goes, well, you know, what's surprising? Cause I don't have some like, you know, amazingly, you know, unique hobby or, you know, talent as far as, you know, that wouldn't be obvious. I think my secret weapon or, you know, one of my talents is that I am very intuitive. So I can read a room very quickly. I can read an audience. I can, you know, I pick up and, you know, I thrive, you know, as an extrovert, I thrive on being in take energy from other people, but I'll notice people's moods. I may not know exactly what's the cause of it, but I'll notice the furrowed brow, I'll notice somebody who's not speaking, somebody who doesn't seem happy or whatever. So I am highly intuitive. The trick, and you know, what I've learned over time is kind of relates back to that asking more questions, is what you do with that information. So a lot of times, like if it was at a group, you know, dinner, I would notice if somebody was being left out. So I would try to pull them in the conversation or whatnot. With clients, I've learned, you know, I can tell that maybe they're getting frustrated or that they're not going to be ready to hear something or whatever. So it being highly intuitive can, you know, you just have to act upon it, ask the good questions and whatnot. I think sometimes when I've surprised people is when I have been so candid, you know, where someone's going, you know, you get the deer in the headlights look, because it's like, oh wow, like, you know, she just told it like it is. Because I will do that. Now, I have learned over the years to temper that with telling it like it is, being direct, telling people what they need to know, and tempering that with empathy. You know, that's where those core values really help, because it's like, wow, you've got to be compassionate, you know, that sort of thing. But fundamentally, sometimes, you know, it's like, wait a minute, you know, no, like, you know, speaking the truth, you know, so most of the time with me, people know where they stand. You know, I actually have learned to not wear my feelings on my sleeve sometimes as much as I, you know, used to. But people really know pretty quickly where they stand with me. But if I'm in a meeting, I'll be happy to speak up and, you know, be vocal and be like, no, I, you know, that's not the way it goes. I think where that can really be helpful sometimes is with clients, because I will have either at a speaking engagement or a personal client of mine, and it's clear maybe that like, this is a train wreck, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I've had a couple just in the last year. In fact, I've had two potential clients that called me and I know that I can't help them. Mm-hmm. And because their mess in, you know, is so bad, I cannot help them. And I told both of them that, but in the kinder, gentler way.
Right.
But I told one of them that I referred them to a leadership coach that I know that's really good. Because I said, if you guys don't get this worked out, I can help you. I can do an assessment of your practice. I can come in. I can do, you know, give you lots of tools and help you implement and affect change. And I can definitely help you with team development. But you guys have such strong, really, you know, significant leadership issues. You got to get those worked out first. Mm-hmm. So I did that. And then I had another situation in the last year with a gal whose practice was in such dire straits that I would have felt guilty taking her any money from her. And I said, you know, if you can weather the storm and get through this, and I, you know, I'm always willing to talk to people and do a, you know, a call. But so I think that may surprise people because they're not sure, you know, they didn't realize that that's what they were going to get. But generally that's kind of a good surprise, because they're like, okay, she's going to tell it like it is.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, I think that's really important. I've had people ask me to do things. I'm like, you know what? That's not my strong suit. And you need to go and talk to these people. And I like you, I've had some partnerships that were so dysfunctional that there was no point in me coming in and trying to help the team, because the partnership itself needed to have a resolution. Who was supposed to do what. And sometimes that means that they just break up, you know, that you just say we're done and we go and do something else. And it is amazing. Somebody said to me one day, it's amazing the messes that veterinarians get themselves into.
Well, you know, yeah, you know, I had my mom and dad worked together. And so I saw, you know, that that could create some significant challenges. And it's interesting because I have had a lot of, I don't know, I've never done the percentage or whatever, but I've definitely had quite a few husband and wife teams that have been clients. And most of the time that's gone really well. But because of my childhood experience, what I know is going into that, I need to be prepared. It's like, okay, everybody gets copied on every email and you both have to be part of the conversation. And I've got to, you know, make sure that they're in sync and that sort of thing. Or, you know, we've got to have clear rules of the road and that kind of thing. But I have had a couple of instances where things did not go well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I have to point out, you know, this is a problem. This has to be resolved, like you said. But it doesn't necessarily matter whether it's a husband and wife or, like you said, a couple of partners. When people are not aligned and they're having trouble, I mean, wow, that can be really challenging.
It is. It really is a challenge. And you feel so bad for them because you know that, you know, there's a really good group of people out here that need this support and need their jobs actually. In realistic, there's no fixing it because sometimes it's just such two divergent personalities that probably should have never gotten together in the first place. And sometimes right. It's just, you know, they both worked at a practice that they hated and they went to go doing something else. Like that you brought the same toxicity over into the one that you started. So we have this problem. Well, Amanda, we could talk about this stuff all day, I know, because we do love this communication stuff. But any final words of wisdom? I do want you to, you know, tell us one more time the title of your book and where people can find it.
Yeah. So the title, the primary title is Leading and Managing Veterinary Teams. And then the subtitle is The Definitive Guide to Veterinary Practice Management. And it is on Amazon. So if you put my name in Amazon's browser, you'll come up with my older book, but then you'll see that one too, and it may come up first now. But Leading and Managing Veterinary Teams, it's right there on Amazon. That's what people need to know. I guess the only other thing to know, if you do the look inside, you can see the table of contents, so you know what the chapters are. There's a little bit, I think, of the first chapter, but the first seven chapters are all about team development, you know, job performance, recruiting, engagement, retention, problem behaviors. I purposely added chapter 8 is operations, chapter 9 is financial management, and chapter 10 is a fairly lengthy chapter on marketing. And Debbie, it's all on client communications because I'm not a digital marketing expert. You know, it's all on internal marketing. But I put those three chapters purposely because I don't think you can lead and manage a team if you don't at least have some knowledge, you know, of operations, financial management, and marketing, because you just don't work in a vacuum and only do leadership and HR management. You've really got to look at everything as a manager, whether you're an owner, a practice manager. And the target audience for this book is practice owners, associates who may want to be an owner or don't want to be an owner, office managers, practice managers, and middle managers, you know, because everything that's in there is, you know, very applicable. So Amazon and
Good. Perfect. I'm glad we have another resource out there in the market and one that's current. You know, I think that Marsha Hunkin's book has been revised again. And of course, it's great. Like Nuts and Bolts is like the Bible of veterinary practice management, of how to do all the pieces and parts. But the leadership part is the difficult part. The people part is the hard part. And if you get the people right, the rest of the stuff is easy in comparison. If you just, you know, but you got to get your team involved and get them all focused and pointed in the right direction, in the same direction. And then wonderful things happen. And it's kind of amazing how a team can flourish and a hospital can flourish when everybody's pointed in the right direction and excited about it. So other than your own book, do you have another book out there in the world that you would recommend? We always like to have a book recommendation.
Oh, yeah. Well, I would be remiss if I didn't recommend, you know, from a veterinary perspective, I always recommend Peter Weinstein's book, The E-Myth Veterinarian, because it is veterinary specific. So I think that's another great veterinary specific book. Of course, I've already mentioned Brené Brown's Dare to Lead. Very close friend of mine just asked multiple leaders to make recommendations for her son for books because he is graduating with a master's. And the other book that I recommended to him was, I believe the title is 9 Things You Simply Must Do to Succeed in Love and Life by Henry, I believe it's Henry Cloud. So Cloud and Townsend are very famous authors, have written Boundaries and, you know, lots of books, but it's 9 Things You Simply Must Do. It's that book. And I've read that twice in my life, but it's really hard to just pin down like one book. You know, I know Peter talked about the success principles from Jack Canfield, and I definitely recommend that book. I thought it was fabulous. And boy, my law of attraction has really been working well for me in the last, you know, few years or so. And so there's so many great books, but there's at least a couple.
Yeah. Thank you. I always love to add to the list. I have a list on my website and I always like to add more to the list from our guests, but you're right. I have a huge library of books and a constant reading list. And there's so much good information out there in the world for us to learn and to put into our lives. I mean, not just necessarily into our business, but into our lives and to make our lives better. So, well, thank you again for your time. And I actually am going to come to Nashville. I'm going to be speaking at Connexity in September. Maybe if we can figure out how to connect when we're out there, who knows where you might be at that point in time. But anyway, I love Nashville. It's one of my favorite towns. And
yeah,
I'm always excited to get an opportunity to come there. And hopefully we will see each other soon at conferences in person with no masks. Yay.
Exactly. Yay. Well, yeah, I hope to see you in Nashville, if not before then.
Okay. All right. Thanks again, Amanda. Appreciate you so much. And all Amanda's information will be in the show notes, how to get in touch with her, how to the link to her book. And again, we appreciate her time today on this episode of The Bend.